Up the Rams versus Commonwealth matter. Mr. Liebig, Ms. Shapiro, Mr. Sandoval. Has everyone signed in, by the way?
Yes.
And who will be arguing it for Mr. Rams? You, Ms. Shapiro?
I will, Your Honor.
All right. And counsel, how much time did you want to reserve for rebuttal?
5 minutes.
All righty.
Thank you.
And counsel, you may begin whenever you're ready.
Megan Shapiro, Your Honors, may it please the Court, on behalf of Mr. Joaquin Rams. This is an unusual case. It's a long record. I spent weeks digesting and breaking down the facts. And having put in all that work, I don't see proof that a murder took place. In preparing for this argument, though, something else crystallized itself for me, and that is that not only do I not see proof of corpus delicti in the record of this case, but the Commonwealth's evidence alone firmly establishes the possibility of a natural death. And isn't that the heart of this case? Was this a murder, or was this a tragic natural death? The concept of corpus delicti itself. And I apologize if I mispronounce that, corpus delicti, corpus delicti. I'm still not sure which
Don't
it is.
Don't worry, everybody pronounces it.
Thank you.
We know what you're talking about.
I appreciate that. The Commonwealth's evidence firmly establishes the possibility of a natural death in this case. But the trial court assumed a position that a murder took place and worked backward from there. The trial court simply lost sight of the lack of corpus delicti. And it might be easy at first glance or even second glance to look at the trial court's detailed, lengthy written verdict and not see right away the errors of logic and the mistakes of fact that it contains. But there are two that I would like to point out to the court that I think stand out most strongly to me. The first is that the trial court ruled irrationally by disregarding the fact that factual findings the trial court himself made supported the possibility, even the likelihood, the strong likelihood of a natural death in this case. And specifically,
but counsel, weren't
yes.
there experts that testified on behalf of the Commonwealth that the death would have occurred either through suffocation or drowning? And I guess the point or question I have for you is, does it matter in terms of which one it is, as long as they're able to establish that it was one of them, or the possibility of one of them, and that it was done at the hands of a criminal agent or actor?
To answer that question as specifically as I can, the evidence from the Commonwealth did establish the possibility of a drowning. That's true. That's exactly what the trial court found, that the evidence established the possibility of a drowning. And the trial court also found that the evidence established the possibility of a suffocation.
Isn't that essentially a finding that death was caused by either the drowning or the suffocation?
The finding was that the death may have been caused by drowning and that the death may have been caused by suffocation. The big part of that puzzle that's
that,
missing.
I guess my question is, if it's an either or, if it's either of those two things, the corpus delicti has been established, right? If it's a drowning or a suffocation.
I just want to phrase this very carefully so that I don't
Understood.
Inadvertently make any concession that I don't intend to. The possibility of drowning and the possibility of suffocation is not enough. Here, there would need to be more evidence in support of the corpus delicti that a murder took place. And here, where there is also evidence that natural death is very possible.
But you have several experts that you would agree that in terms of expert testimony, there are certain facts, obviously, that they're going to rely on. And they're going to come before the trier of fact. And the trier of fact is going to make a credibility determination as to which expert either the jury and or a judge in this particular case might believe. Is that fair to say?
Of course, there will always be credibility determinations in a trial.
So if in fact, you have experts on both sides essentially saying different things, but the experts that are apparently in this particular case held to be credible by the court are the ones who are testifying that the death was either through suffocation or through drowning, then where does that put this court in reference to your argument?
That question just perfectly frames the problem that I want to address, which is that we're not talking about a situation here where you have a credibility determination in favor of Commonwealth's experts over defense experts. This is a situation where the Commonwealth's experts, the Commonwealth's evidence, establish not only the possibility of drowning or the possibility of suffocation, but also establish the possibility of natural death and refute the possibility of drowning
but
as well as suffocation.
Don't triers of fact all the time have to make a determination when all of the evidence is before them? If something is, I mean, that's the whole point of the corpus delicti rule, is that they have to look at all the evidence, make a determination, was it a crime or was it a natural death? And oftentimes there's evidence that could suggest that it might have been, and that gets rejected in light of the other evidence that the trier of fact deems more credible. So I'm having a little trouble figuring where you're going with this.
Let me try to explain myself a little bit better. I have two responses to the issue that you raise. The first is, there is a point where a trial judge acts arbitrarily in disregarding evidence before it, specifically when that evidence is introduced by the Commonwealth. And we cite to cases in support of that in our briefing.
Well, what do you say about Dr. Chenard's, because it seems like the trial court put a lot of credibility in terms of its ruling on Dr. Chenard. And Dr. Chenard was very clear about ruling out SIDS and other types of natural death and indicating that it was, in fact, you know, a means that could be attributable to a criminal actor. So if the court's allowed to do that, and it appears from the trial court's ruling, that's what it did, where does that put your argument in reference to the corpus delicti?
I want to fully address Dr. Chenard's testimony, so if you would just give me the space to make sure that I explain this fully, I would be very appreciative. Dr. Chenard testified, not inconsistently with the other Commonwealth's evidence that I am referring to now, and I want to lay this out for you. The Commonwealth's evidence in support of a natural death case included the testimony of Dr. Chenard. But to begin with, the Commonwealth's evidence included the expert opinions of Dr. Gormley in the form of his written, amended, the formal autopsy report in this case that was admitted as part of the Commonwealth's case in chief, which determined and opined that natural death was possible in this case. The Commonwealth's evidence also included the written opinion of Dr. Corey, a consulting expert for the Commonwealth, and that written opinion clearly stated that a natural death in this case was highly probable, and that the only reason that she would not be applying the formal label of SUDC, another form of SIDS, which I'll be referring to as SUDC, but sudden unexplained death in childhood. So the only reason she concluded that she could not apply the formal label to Prince, the victim in this case, the decedent, was that there was a report that he was found convulsing or seizing when he was picked up from his crib. So just to reiterate that, but for the report that baby had been found convulsing or seizing when picked up from his crib, she would have diagnosed SUDC.
But the report is from the appellant, and the court is either free to believe or disbelieve the appellant in terms of that report.
That's exactly right.
And the doctor acknowledges that the underlying opinion is based on that reporting. So clearly it's in reference to whatever that accuracy is.
No, that's exactly right.
How do you answer that, though, in response to where the trial court then found that that could not be possible given the core body temperature having dropped, the condition of the child when found, and the short time frame between when the reporting of the seizures and the response time of the EMT?
Your Honor, I fully embrace the factual finding by the trial court in this case that Prince was not convulsing or seizing when he was picked up from that crib. So to be, I want that to be clear. We don't dispute that factual finding. That is a factual finding that the trial court made. In light of that factual finding,
so you Dr. only dispute court, other factual findings that the trial court made.
We dispute, and this is one that I'll point out to you that I believe this that our position is that the trial judge used irrational and arbitrary logic in applying that factual finding. Because
how does a trial judge act irrationally and arbitrarily when there's evidence in support of the trial judge's decision? How is that irrational or arbitrary, which is a pretty harsh thing, I think, to say about a trial judge?
I agree it's harsh language. I'm only trying to adopt the language of the standard of review for this court.
And I have another question.
Yes, Your Honor. If I could address the first question, the trial judge's factual finding that the child was not seizing means that Dr. Corey's expert opinion, admitted by the Commonwealth in this case as part of its case in chief, is that SUDC is a reasonable diagnosis in this case, in fact, the likely diagnosis. And Dr. Shinar's testimony, to get back to your question, Judge Melvo, was exactly the same as Dr. Corey's on that point. I do want to reserve some time for rebuttal, but I want to make sure I answer your question, Judge.
Very early in your argument before us, you said, for corpus delicti, was it accidental or intentional? You said there's no other evidence other than the expert. What about the insurance policies? Could the judge consider that in determining whether it was accidental or intentional? Don't you find all these insurance policies taken out a factor, a circumstantial factor that the trial court could consider?
It is a circumstantial factor that is relevant to who committed a crime. In this case, not relevant, Your Honor, to whether a crime took place, whether the corpus delicti exists. And I would draw your attention to the numerous cases that we cite in our briefing, particularly cases involving arson from courts in this state.
What about Abdel that talks about, I mean, clearly you can look to motive as a circumstantial factor, can't you?
Motive is a circumstantial factor relevant to who committed a crime, and in this case, not relevant to the corpus delicti.
No, it's relevant to proof of corpus delicti.
I'll have to agree to disagree with you, Judge Decker. If you look at the cases that we
You don't read Abdel as to say that?
You would have to remind me of the circumstances of Abdel, but I would direct you to the cases of arson as well as the case of Betancourt before this court, where there actually was very similar evidence of motive, specifically life insurance policies, but where the murder could, where the possibility was left open by the evidence that whether that murder was an accidental death or a suicide or a criminal act, the motive was irrelevant to the analysis of whether the corpus delicti was established. And I would like to reserve some time.
Okay. Counsel, we've asked you a lot of questions. I'm going to give you an additional 2 minutes, okay?
Thank
On
you.
Your rebuttal time.
Thank you. I appreciate that.
Mr. Sandoval? Morning.
Good morning, Your Honors, and may it please the Court, Chris Shandoval for the Commonwealth in this appeal. This is an unusual case, but it's unusual primarily because of the heinous nature of the crime that was committed. The evidence in the record established that Mr. Rams took out over $500,000 of life insurance on his infant child at a time when he owed approximately $500,000 in mortgage payments on the home that he loved and had been forced to move out of.
And Mr. Shandoval, sorry to stop you so early in your argument, but going back to Judge Haley's question, how does that evidence fit in with the corpus delicti, and do you have case authority to support that, using that evidence to support the corpus delicti?
Yes, Your Honor. I think it absolutely does. It is relevant to proving the corpus delicti. What Virginia's appellate courts have said on multiple times, including cases like Bowie and Nicholas, is that circumstantial evidence can be used to prove the corpus delicti. Now, those cases didn't involve motive specifically, but did say that you can rely on circumstantial evidence in proving corpus delicti.
I don't think that your opposing counsel disagrees that circumstantial evidence can be used. I think their point is that with regard to motive.
Right, and they've cited cases on brief that they assert stands for the proposition that motive is irrelevant and cannot be considered in establishing corpus delicti. It's a clever argument. The problem with that argument is that the Virginia case law simply does not support it. The cases they've cited, none of those cases stand for the proposition that motive is irrelevant to proving corpus delicti. They rely primarily initially on the Van Dyke case and the Farrell case. And cite those cases with the proposition that motive is only relevant to proving who committed the crime, not relevant to proving whether a crime actually occurred. Neither of those cases even mention the phrase corpus delicti. So neither of those cases stand for the proposition that motive cannot be considered as a part of the circumstantial evidence that's considered in determining motive. I will confess to the court that I did not read Abdel, and perhaps I should have. But it sounds like, from the court's description, that in Abdel the court did look to motive in establishing corpus delicti. I think that's consistent with an approach that says you look at all the circumstances surrounding the cause of death. Virginia's appellate courts have said that oftentimes even when you have the dead body, a simple autopsy is not enough to determine whether or not that individual died from natural causes or died from a crime. And for that reason, you have to look at circumstantial evidence in establishing whether a crime was occurred. And I think it's certainly relevant to determining whether an individual who is found dead died from natural causes or died from some criminal act or committed by another person.
So the fact that there's $500,000 worth of insurance on a 15-month-old is significant to determine whether, or is at least relevant to determine whether the act was a crime or not.
Yes, Your Honor. And perhaps if we had a circumstance where there was no evidence in the record that the defendant, the person with the motive, had been anywhere near the victim at the time that the victim died, perhaps in that circumstance that individual's motive would be separate and not to be considered in establishing whether the corpus delicti occurred. But when you have a case like we have here, where the only individual over the age of 12 who was present with the victim during the window of time when the victim died had a strong financial motive for killing that victim. And then after the fact, these are some other circumstances that are relevant. So I do think that motive is relevant, given the fact that the only individual present with him had a strong financial motive to kill him. That's certainly relevant first to establishing whether or not that victim died from natural causes or the criminal agency of another. And then it's the second question, of course, proving it's a subsequent question whether or not the defendant himself was responsible. But there is no case law that says that those considerations have to be kept completely separate and that motive cannot be considered in both. The other cases that are cited on brief Virginia cases are simply cases where Virginia courts do the analysis in a two-step process and say, first, we're going to ask whether corpus delicti was proven, and second, we're going to ask whether they proved criminal agency of the defendant. But in none of those cases does the court ever even state or imply that you cannot consider motive or other circumstances specific to this individual defendant in determining whether the corpus delicti was proved. It'd be like saying, in a case where an eyewitness saw the defendant stand over the victim and stab him in the heart with a needle, that in proving the corpus delicti of that crime, whether or not the victim's death was caused by natural causes or the criminal agency of another, you're not allowed to consider the eyewitness's testimony. He testified that the defendant was the one who stood over that victim and stabbed him in the heart with a needle and yelled, "This is because of what you did for my wife." That evidence is certainly relevant to determining whether or not that victim died as a result of natural causes or the criminal agency of another. It also helps to prove the defendant was that criminal agent, but it's certainly relevant to corpus delicti as well.
In Virginia, is there anything you're aware of, that any limitation to use of circumstantial evidence to prove anything?
Not that I'm aware of, Your Honor. Virginia courts have repeatedly held that circumstantial evidence is just as competent to prove a crime as direct evidence. I'm sorry, I'm happy to take the court's question.
By analogy, suppose someone shoots somebody and they die. Can you put on evidence, well, this person had severe heart disease and he might have died of a heart attack before he got shot?
The defense would certainly be entitled to put on that sort of evidence. But in making a determination,
That's similar, I think, by analogy to what we have here. I mean, can you argue, well, no, he might have died of a heart attack, and therefore you can't convict him of murder?
Those arguments can certainly be made. And then it is up to the fact finder to determine whether or not the evidence in the record supports the conclusion that a crime was committed, or whether or not there is evidence in the record supporting a reasonable hypothesis of innocence. And what the Virginia Supreme Court has said repeatedly in cases like Hudson and more recently in Mosley is that in a case where the defendant is putting forth hypotheses of innocence, those hypotheses have to be disproved. The trier of fact has to reject them. The only question for this court on appeal is whether a rational fact finder could have rejected the hypothesis of innocence and could have accepted the hypotheses of guilt. And in this case, that was not an all and arbitrary determination made by the trial court. I will submit to the court that the Judge Bellows' 62-page letter opinion was the antithesis of arbitrary.
Well, so what about counsel's argument that essentially the judge sort of did things in reverse and flipped the burden?
Virginia courts, appellate courts, have repeatedly held that any time a finder of fact convicts a defendant, the finder of fact has, by a process of elimination, ruled out all the proposed hypotheses of innocence and come to the conclusion that the defendant, the only remaining hypothesis, is one of guilt. Usually that's done by a jury or by a fact finder who does not explain its reasoning, and so it's implied that that process of elimination occurred. In this case, the trier of fact showed his work, submitted a letter of opinion, and explained, these are the reasons why I've ruled out all the hypotheses of innocence that have been proposed by the defense based on credible evidence in the record. And having ruled out all natural causes of death, I'm left with two remaining possibilities. And the possibilities are a cause of death by drowning or a cause of death by suffocation.
And what about that language possibility? How does that fit into the beyond a reasonable doubt?
The trier of fact, Judge Bellows, explicitly wrote, I find beyond a reasonable doubt that only two possible explanations for the victim's death remain, drowning or suffocation. So he made the beyond a reasonable doubt finding and concluded that the defendant killed
the child. So it was really an either-or.
Correct.
So beyond a reasonable doubt by either drowning or suffocation.
Correct, Your Honor. And that distinction would only matter if Virginia were a state where the Commonwealth were required to prove a specific cause of death in order to convict the defendant for murder. And, of course, we know that's not the case. You'd almost never be able to get a conviction in a case where the body of the victim was never found, for example.
Epperly.
What's that? Exactly, Epperly. And we know that it's permissible for a Commonwealth to get a conviction for in a case where the body is not found, so long as the Commonwealth proves that a murder occurred, a death at the hands of another occurred, and that the defendant was a criminal agent. And that is exactly what occurred here. That's exactly what the trier of fact found beyond a reasonable doubt. And for that reason, Rams cannot come to the courtroom today and say that, well, his conviction should be reversed because the Commonwealth failed to prove whether he drowned his son or whether he suffocated his son. The Commonwealth proved that he either drowned or suffocated his son, and that was sufficient to convict Mr. Rams for murder.
Can you address opposing counsel relied on Betancourt? Can you address whether Betancourt supports their analysis or not?
As I read Betancourt and as I read their reliance on Betancourt, the argument that they're making is because of the order in which the court did its analysis, because the court first considered corpus electi and then later considered criminal agency, that somehow proves or implies that motive is irrelevant to proving corpus electi. But the court never says that in that opinion, and Virginia courts have never said that evidence of motive cannot be considered in proving corpus electi. So that simply is not the law in Virginia. I know they cite some cases from other states, one of which is a case in California, which relies on another California case where the court in that case simply said, for the purpose of argument, we're going to assume with the appellant that you're not to consider motive in determining corpus electi. So they just assumed the issue. Even that case from California doesn't fully support the proposition that they're arguing for here today. So we would submit that motive is absolutely relevant. What else is absolutely relevant is the lies that Mr. Rams told to the medical personnel after they arrived with this supposed claimed seizure that the trial court found was all a charade to pretend as if Mr. Rams' son had a seizure. What Mr. Rams told the medical personnel is that he was warm, he was hot, he was still breathing, he was still gasping for air, and that he was shaking, so he was having a seizure. And after all the medical expert testimony came in, it became very clear that this child was in cardiac arrest from the time that he was in the crib before Mr. Rams ever went into the room and picked him up out of the bed. If he's in cardiac arrest, the medical testimony is he could not have been shaking, and given the drop in his temperature, he could not have been as hot as Mr. Rams claimed he was. And now on appeal, what they've done is they've conceded that those statements that Mr. Rams made were false. The statements that his son was seizing, the statement that his son was hot, those statements are false, and that those concessions are in opposing counsel's brief. And the importance of those concessions is the trial court found if this child had died from natural causes, Mr. Rams would have no reason to lie about the condition in which he found him. So the fact that he told lies and said, no, he was shaking, no, he was very hot, the fact that those statements were untrue supports the conclusion, bolsters the conclusion, that the corpus delicti was established because he wouldn't have told those lies if the child had died from natural causes. The only reason to tell those lies is to cover up a crime that he himself had committed, therefore further establishing that the corpus delicti was proven in this case.
Can you speak to the testimony of Shadow?
Yes, Your Honor. So there's an argument made, and it's been made here again this morning, an argument that just because some of the witnesses who testified for the Commonwealth, the trial court was therefore bound and required to accept factually and credit everything that those witnesses testified to. We know from Virginia case law that that is not the case. When there are contradictions in the record, in the evidence, even contradictions among the Commonwealth's own witnesses, the finder of fact is entitled to resolve those contradictions. And on appeal, those contradictions must be read in the light most favorable to the Commonwealth.
So what about the theory that the Commonwealth can't rise above its own evidence?
Right. So the theory that the Commonwealth can't rise above its own evidence falls apart when there are contradictions in the record. There's a case, Massey versus Firmstone, where the Supreme Court of Virginia said that while that's normally true, if there are multiple witnesses who testify for the Commonwealth, or the party with the multiple witnesses allowed to rely upon the witness that supports his theory of the case. I'd like to direct the court's attention to a case called Williams versus Commonwealth, which I did not cite on brief, and actually found yesterday in my research, but I did send a copy to opposing counsel yesterday afternoon. It is at 234 VA 168. In that case, it was also a battle of the experts. It's a case decided by the Supreme Court in 1987. In that case, you had two medical experts who testified both for the Commonwealth. One, the local medical examiner testified for the Commonwealth and said, we don't know the victim's cause of death. It might have been by natural causes. A second medical examiner testified for the Commonwealth, a medical examiner who actually performed the autopsy, and said, no, based on my conclusions, this victim died from blunt force trauma. And so the argument on appeal was that, well, the Commonwealth can't rise above its own evidence. You put on an expert who said that this victim might have died from natural causes. And what the Supreme Court of Virginia said in this Williams case, 234 VA 168, the alleged conflict in the testimony of these two experts was a matter for the jury to resolve. No litigant is bound by contradicted testimony of a witness, even though proffered by the litigant. The jury must resolve any conflict between the witnesses. That was the same here. Even though some of the expert witnesses who said, sure, there might be some conceivable possibility that natural causes could have been involved, even though some of those witnesses were Commonwealth witnesses, we also had Commonwealth witnesses. Dr. D'Angelo, who performed the autopsy and was in the best position to draw conclusions from that autopsy, who said, no, I believe that the cause of death was drowning. You had Dr. Gormley, who testified and said, yes, drowning still remains very high in the list of possibilities. Suffocation is also a possibility. And yes, Dr. Gormley did say, I personally couldn't rule out natural causes of death. But we had Dr. Shinar and Dr. Foster, who both testified in rebuttal and explained all the different reasons from the evidence and from the victim's own medical history and their own findings why those natural causes of death could be ruled out. So when there are conflicts in the evidence, and there are conflicts between Shadow's testimony and the testimony of the justices, and, of course, the testimony of all the expert testimony about the way this timeline of events occurred, when there are other conflicts in the evidence, the finder of fact is entitled, it's his or her role or the jury's role to make those determinations and to decide who to credit. And that determination can only be overruled on appeal if it was in some way arbitrary. And in this case, the trier of fact, the trial judge explained its reasons for not crediting Shadow's testimony. And it wasn't because the finder of fact believed that Shadow was on the stand trying to lie. It was because Shadow was a young boy. These were events that aren't very memorable at the time that they were occurring. He was playing video games, so he was distracted. His testimony conflicted with the testimony of the justices about the timeline of events and how long things took to occur. So for all these reasons, the trier of fact made a very rational decision not to credit his testimony about what occurred.
All right, and because of that, thank you, Mr. Schoenvall. Your time is up.
All right, thank you, Your Honors. For all these reasons, we would ask the court to affirm.
Ms. Shapiro.
Thank you, Judge. To start from the end of the Commonwealth's argument, Shadow is a critical part of this case. Shadow, a teenage boy, was not only a witness presented by the Commonwealth. His testimony was unimpeached. He was not a hostile witness. And contrary to what the Commonwealth just argued to you, his testimony was not inconsistent with the physical evidence in this case or other witness testimony in this case. This is not a situation where multiple Commonwealth witnesses gave conflicting testimony about what factually happened. Shadow's testimony was uncontradicted, and this is explored in great detail in the briefing, and I would like to rest on the discussion in the briefing on that point and move on to something else that I think is critical to point out. The Commonwealth stated that the judge here, it, quote, accepted hypotheses of guilt. That's exactly what the judge did here, and that's exactly what is not enough. Accepting a hypothesis of guilt is not the equivalent of saying that the Commonwealth met its burden of proof.
Let me ask you this. So if the judge had said, I find that the defendant is guilty beyond a reasonable doubt because the cause of death and the corpus delicti has been established and the cause of death was either drowning or suffocation, what about that? Is that enough?
If the Commonwealth proved the possibility of drowning beyond a reasonable doubt and also proved the possibility of suffocation beyond a reasonable doubt, then that could be enough. Here, that's
okay,
not what happened.
Okay.
And in addition to that problem, it was unreasonable of the trial court to say that he ruled out the possibility of SUDC, as a natural cause of death. Just to take one example, it was unreasonable for him to rule that because his own factual findings and the evidence of the Commonwealth firmly supported the possibility of the natural cause of death. That evidence from the Commonwealth came from Dr. Corey, Dr. Gormley, and Dr. Shinar, who all testified to the possibility of natural death. And specifically regarding SUDC, Dr. Corey to the likelihood of SUDC, but for if the child was found seizing. And Dr. Shinar, the identical opinion. The trial court here found the child was not seizing, and it was therefore unreasonable and, yes, respectfully, irrationally, for the trial court to find that SUDC was disproven. It was not.
Isn't it always possible that someone died of natural causes before they were shot, stabbed, or strangled? Doesn't that possibility exist in every death?
You may be interested in particular a couple of cases that are cited in our briefing, but not extrapolated much as to their facts. But the case of Williams versus Commonwealth, 130 Virginia 778. And the case of Terry versus Commonwealth, 171 Virginia 5.
Whoa, slow.
Yes.
Can you go back,
Judge,
and do that again?
Williams versus Commonwealth. This is a different Williams.
130 Virginia.
778.
778?
Yes, sir.
All right.
Terry, 171 Virginia 505.
Did you cite these in your brief? I thought
yes,
so.
Yes, Judge.
Okay.
I mentioned
so
Betancourt and Lane, which is also cited in the brief. These are cases where a body was present in evidence, but it was not established that the death was not natural. And in particular with regard to the first two cases I mentioned, Terry and Williams, in those cases, there weren't just suspicious circumstances that perhaps the accused had assaulted or harmed the deceased. There was actually evidence that they had assaulted the deceased, and the only question was whether the deceased passed away because of that assault or because of a coincidental or ill-timed natural cause that could not be ruled out by the state's evidence. And corpus delicti was not found to be proved because the state's evidence established the remaining possibility of natural death. I know my time is up.
Thank you, Mr. Fair. We're going to come down.